Books on Tape presents 20s Girl by Sophie Kinsella. Read by Rosalind Landor. Chapter 1.
The thing about lying to your parents is you have to do it to protect them. It's for their own good. I mean, take my own parents. If they knew the unvarnished truth about my finances, / love life, / plumbing, / council tax, they'd have instant heart attacks, and the doctor would say,
"Did anyone give them a terrible shock?"
And it would all be my fault. Therefore, they have been in my flat for approximately 10 minutes, and already I have told them the following lies. 1. L&N Executive Recruitment will start making profits soon. I'm sure of it. 2. Natalie is a fantastic business partner, and it was a really brilliant idea to chuck in my job to become a headhunter with her. 3. Of course I don't just exist on pizza, black cherry yogurts and vodka. 4. Yes, I did know about interest on parking tickets. 5. Yes, I did watch that Charles Dickens DVD they gave me for Christmas. It was great, especially that lady in the bonnet. Yes, Peggotty. That's who I meant. 6. I was actually intending to buy a smoke alarm at the weekend. What a coincidence they should mention it. 7. Yes, it'll be nice to see all the family again. 7 lies, not including all the ones about Mum's outfit. And we haven't even mentioned the subject. As I come out of my bedroom in a black dress and hastily applied mascara, I see Mum looking at my overdue phone bill on the mantelpiece. "Don't worry," I say quickly. "I'm going to sort that out." "Only if you don't," says Mum, "they'll cut off your line, and it'll take ages for you to get it installed again, and the mobile signal is so patchy here. What if there was an emergency? What would you do?" Her brow is creased with anxiety. She looks as though this is all totally imminent, as though there's a woman screaming in labour in the bedroom, and floods are rising outside the window, and how will we contact the helicopter? How? "Oh, I hadn't thought about it. Mum, I'll pay the bill, honest." Mum's always been a worrier. She gets this tense smile with distant, frightened eyes, and you just know she's playing out some apocalyptic scenario in her head. She looked like that throughout my last speech day at school. Afterward, she confessed she'd suddenly noticed a chandelier hanging above on a rickety chain and became obsessed by what would happen if it fell down on the girls' heads and splintered into smithereens. Now she tugs at her black suit, which has shoulder pads and weird metal buttons, and is swamping her. I vaguely remember it from about 10 years ago, when she had a phase of going on job interviews, and I had to teach her all the really basic computer stuff, like how to use a mouse. She ended up working for a children's charity, which doesn't have a formal dress code, thank goodness. No one in my family looks good in black. Dad's wearing a suit made out of a dull black fabric, which flattens all his features. He's actually quite handsome, my dad, in a kind of fine-boned, understated way. His hair is brown and wispy, whereas Mum's is fair and wispy like mine. They both look really great when they're relaxed and on their own territory, like, say, when we're all in Cornwall on Dad's rickety old boat, wearing fleeces and eating pasties, or when Mum and Dad are playing in their local amateur orchestra, which is where they first met. But today, nobody's relaxed. "So, are you ready?" Mum glances at my stockinged feet. "Where are your shoes, darling?" I slump down on the sofa. "Do I have to go?" "Laura," says Mum chidingly. "She was your great aunt. She was 105, you know." Mum has told me my great aunt was 105, approximately 105 times. I'm pretty sure it's because that's the only fact she knows about her. "So what? I didn't know her. None of us knew her. This is so stupid. Why are we schlepping to Potter's Bar for some crumbly old woman we didn't even ever meet?" I hunch my shoulders up, feeling more like a sulky 3-year-old than a mature 27-year-old with her own business.
"Uncle Bill and the others are going," says Dad. "And if they can make the effort,
"It's a family occasion," puts in Mum brightly. My shoulders hunch even harder. I'm allergic to family occasions. Sometimes I think we'd do better as dandelion seeds. No family, no history, just floating off into the world, each on our own piece of fluff. "It won't take long," Mum says coaxingly. "It will." I stare at the carpet. "And everyone will ask me about things." "No, they won't," says Mum at once, glancing at Dad for backup. "No one will even mention things." There's silence. The subject is hovering in the air. It's as though we're all avoiding looking at it. At last, Dad plunges in.
"So, speaking of things..."
He hesitates.
"Are you generally okay?"
I can see Mum listening on super high alert, even though she's pretending to be concentrating on combing her hair. "Oh, you know," I say after a pause, "I'm fine. I mean, you can't expect me just to snap back into..."
"No, of course not."
Dad immediately backs off. Then he tries again.
"But you're in good spirits?"
I nod assent. "Good," says Mum, looking relieved. "I knew you'd get over things." My parents don't say Josh out loud anymore, because of the way I used to dissolve into heaving sobs whenever I heard his name. For a while, Mum referred to him as "he who must not be named." Now he's just things.
"And you haven't been in touch with him?"
Dad is looking anywhere but at me, and Mum appears engrossed in her handbag. That's another euphemism. What he means is, have you sent him any more obsessive texts? "No," I say, flushing. "I haven't, okay?" It's so unfair of him to bring that up. In fact, the whole thing was totally blown out of proportion. I only sent Josh a few texts, 3 a day, if that. Hardly any. And they weren't obsessive. They were just me being honest and open, which, by the way, you're supposed to be in a relationship. I mean, you can't just switch off your feelings because the other person did, can you? You can't just say, "Oh, right, so your plan is we never see each other again, never make love again, never talk or communicate in any way." Fab idea, Josh. Why didn't I think of that? So, what happens is, you write your true feelings down in a text, simply because you want to share them, and next minute your ex-boyfriend changes his phone number and tells your parents. He's such a sneak.
"Lara, I know you were very hurt, and this has been a painful time for you."
Dad clears his throat.
"But it's been nearly 2 months now. You've got to move on, darling. See other young men. Go out and enjoy yourself."
Oh, God. I can't face another of Dad's lectures about how plenty of men are going to fall at the feet of a beauty like me. I mean, for a start, there aren't any men in the world. Everyone knows that. And a 5'3" girl with a snubby nose and no suntan isn't exactly a beauty. Okay, I know I look all right sometimes. I have a heart-shaped face, wide-set green eyes, and a few freckles over my nose. And, to top it off, I have this little bee-stung mouth which no one else in my family has. But take it from me, I'm no supermodel. "So, is that what you did when you and Mum broke up that time in Polzeath? Go out and see other people?" I can't help throwing it out, even though this is going over old ground. Dad sighs and exchanges glances with Mum. "We should never have told her about that," she murmurs, rubbing her brow. "We should never have mentioned it." "Because if you'd done that," I continue inexorably, "you would never have got back together again, would you? Dad would never have said that he was the bow to your violin, and you would never have got married." This line about the bow and the violin has made it into family lore. I've heard the story a zillion times. Dad arrived at Mum's house, all sweaty because he'd been riding on his bike, and she'd been crying, but she pretended she had a cold, and they made up their fight, and Granny gave them tea and shortbread. I don't know why the shortbread is relevant, but it always gets mentioned.
"Lara, darling," Mum sighs, "that was very different. We'd been together 3 years. We were engaged."
"I know," I say defensively. "I know it was different. I'm just saying people do sometimes get back together. It does happen." There's silence.
"Lara, you've always been a romantic soul," begins Dad.
"I'm not romantic," I exclaim, as though this is a deadly insult. I'm staring at the carpet, rubbing the pile with my toe, but in my peripheral vision I can see Mum and Dad, each mouthing vigorously at the other to speak next. Mum's shaking her head and pointing at Dad as though to say, "You go."
"When you break up with someone,"
Dad starts again in an awkward rush,
"it's easy to look backward and think life would be perfect if you got back together, but..."
He's going to tell me how life is an escalator. I have to head him off quick. "Dad, listen, please." Somehow I muster my calmest tones. "You've got it all wrong. I don't want to get back together with Josh." I try to sound as if this is a ridiculous idea. That's not why I texted him. I just wanted closure. I mean, he broke things off with no warning, no talking, no discussion. I never got any answers. It's like unfinished business. It's like reading an Agatha Christie and never knowing who done it. There, now they'll understand.
"Well," says Dad at length, "I can understand your frustrations."
"That's all I ever wanted," I say as convincingly as I can. "To understand what Josh was thinking, to talk things over, to communicate like two civilized human beings. And to get back together with him," my mind adds, like a silent, truthful arrow. Because I know Josh still loves me, even if no one else thinks so. But there's no point saying that to my parents. They'd never get it. How could they? They have no concept of how amazing Josh and I were as a couple, how we fit together perfectly. They don't understand how he obviously made a panicked, rushed, boy-type decision, based on some non-existent reason, probably, and how if I could just talk to him, I'm sure I could straighten everything out and we'd be together again. Sometimes I feel streets ahead of my parents, just like Einstein must have done when his friends kept saying,
"The universe is straight, Albert. Take it from us."
And inside, he was secretly thinking,
"I know it's curved. I'll show you one day."
Mum and Dad are surreptitiously mouthing at each other again. I should put them out of their misery. "Anyway, you mustn't worry about me," I say hastily, "because I have moved on. I mean, okay, maybe I haven't moved on totally," I amend as I see their dubious expressions. "But I've accepted that Josh doesn't want to talk. I've realized that it just wasn't meant to be. I've learned a lot about myself, and I'm in a good place, really." My smile is pasted on my face. I feel like I'm chanting the mantra of some wacky cult. I should be wearing robes and banging a tambourine. "Hare, hare! I've moved on. Hare, hare. I'm in a good place." Dad and Mum exchange looks. I have no idea whether they believe me, but at least I've given us all a way out of this sticky conversation.
"That's the spirit,"
Dad says, looking relieved.
"Well done, Lara. I knew you'd get there. And you've got the business with Natalie to focus on, which is obviously going tremendously well."
My smile becomes even more cult-like. "Absolutely. Hare, hare. My business is going well. Hare, hare. It's not a disaster at all." "I'm so glad you've come through this." Mum comes over and kisses the top of my head. "Now, we'd better get going. Find yourself some black shoes. Chop, chop." With a resentful sigh, I get to my feet and drag myself into my bedroom. It's a beautiful, sunshiny day, and I get to spend it at a hideous family occasion involving a dead 105-year-old person. Sometimes life really sucks. As we pull up in the drab little car park of the Potter's Bar Funeral Centre, I notice a small crowd of people outside a side door. Then I see the glint of a TV camera and a fluffy microphone bobbing above people's heads. What's going on? I peer out the car window. Something to do with Uncle Bill?
Probably.
Dad nods. I think someone's doing a documentary about him, Mum puts in. Trudy mentioned it, for his book. This is what happens when one of your relations is a celebrity. You get used to TV cameras being around, and people saying when you introduce yourself,
Lington? Any relation to Lington's coffee? Ha ha!
And them being gobsmacked when you say, yes. My Uncle Bill is the Bill Lington, who started Lington's Coffee from nothing at the age of 26 and built it up into a worldwide empire of coffee shops. His face is printed on every single coffee cup, which makes him more famous than the Beatles or something. You'd recognize him if you saw him. And right now, he's even more high profile than usual because his autobiography, Two Little Coins, came out last month and is a bestseller. Apparently, Pierce Brosnan might play him in the movie. Of course, I've read it from cover to cover. It's all about how he was down to his last 20 pence and bought a coffee, and it tasted so terrible it gave him the idea to run coffee shops. So he opened one and started a chain, and now he pretty much owns the world. His nickname is The Alchemist, and according to some article last year, the entire business world would like to know the secrets of his success. That's why he started his Two Little Coin seminars. I secretly went to one a few months ago, just in case I could get some tips on running a brand new business. There were 200 people there, all lapping up every word, and at the end we had to hold two coins up in the air and say, "This is my beginning." It was totally cheesy and embarrassing, but everyone around me seemed really inspired. Personally speaking, I was listening hard all the way through, and I still don't know how he did it. I mean, he was 26 when he made his first million. 26! He just started a business and became an instant success. Whereas I started a business 6 months ago, and all I've become is an instant head case. Maybe you and Natalie will write a book about your business one day, says Mum, as though she can read my mind.
Global domination is just around the corner,
chimes in Dad heartily. Look, a squirrel! I point hastily out the window. My parents have been so supportive of my business, I can't tell them the truth, so I just change the subject whenever they mention it. To be strictly accurate, you could say Mum wasn't instantly supportive. In fact, you could say that when I first announced I was giving up my marketing job and taking out all my savings to start a headhunting company, having never been a headhunter in my life or knowing anything about it, she went into total meltdown. But she calmed down when I explained I was going into partnership with my best friend Natalie, and that Natalie was a top executive headhunter and would be fronting the business at first while I did the admin and marketing and learned the skills of headhunting myself, and that we already had several contracts lined up and would pay off the bank loan in no time. It all sounded like such a brilliant plan. It was a brilliant plan. Until a month ago, when Natalie went on holiday, fell in love with a Goan beach bum, and texted me a week later to say she didn't know exactly when she'd be coming back, but the details of everything were in the computer, and I'd be fine, and the surf was fabulous out here. I should really visit. Big kisses, Natalie. Kiss, 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 kiss. I am never going into business with Natalie again, ever. Now, is this off? Mum is jabbing uncertainly at her mobile phone. I can't have it ringing during the service.
Let's have a look.
Dad pulls into a parking space, turns off the engine and takes it.
You want to put it on silent mode?
No, says Mum in alarm. I want it off. The silent mode may malfunction.
Here we are, then.
Dad presses the side button.
All off.
He hands it back to Mum, who eyes it anxiously. But what if it somehow turns itself back on while it's in my bag? She looks pleadingly at both of us. That happened to Mary at the boat club, you know. The thing just came alive in her handbag and rang while she was doing jury duty. They said she must have bumped it or touched it somehow. Her voice is rising and becoming breathless. This is where my sister Tonya would lose patience and snap,
"Don't be so stupid, Mum. Of course your phone won't turn itself on."
"Mum," I take it gently from her, "how about we leave it in the car?" "Yes," she relaxes a little. "Yes, that's a good idea. I'll put it in the glove compartment." I glance at Dad, who gives me a tiny smile. Poor Mum. All this ridiculous stuff going on in her head. She really needs to get things in proportion. As we approach the funeral centre, I hear Uncle Bill's distinctive drawl carrying on the air, and sure enough, as we make our way through the little crowd, there he is, with his leather jacket and permatan and springy hair. Everyone knows Uncle Bill is obsessed about his hair. It's thick and luxuriant and jet black, and if any newspaper ever suggests that he dyes it, he threatens to sue them.
"Family's the most important thing," he's saying to an interviewer in jeans. "Family is the rock we all stand on. If I have to interrupt my schedule for a funeral, then so be it."
I can see the admiration pass through the crowd. One girl, who's holding a Lington's takeaway cup, is clearly beside herself and keeps whispering to her friend, "It's really him."
"If we could leave it there for now."
One of Uncle Bill's assistants approaches the cameraman.
"Bill has to go into the funeral home. Thanks, guys. Just a few autographs,"
he adds to the crowd. We wait patiently at the side until everyone has got Uncle Bill to scribble on their coffee cups and funeral programmes with a Sharpie while the camera films them. Then, at last, they melt away and Uncle Bill heads over our way.
"Hi, Michael. Good to see you."
He shakes Dad's hand, then immediately turns back to an assistant.
"Have you got Steve on the line yet? Here."
The assistant hastily hands Uncle Bill a phone.
"Hello, Bill."
Dad is always unfailingly polite to Uncle Bill.
"It's been a while. How are you doing? Congratulations on your book."
"Thank you for the signed copy," puts in Mum brightly. Bill nods briefly at all of us, then says straight into the phone,
"Steve, I got your email."
Mum and Dad exchange glances. Obviously that's the end of our big family catch-up. "Let's find out where we're supposed to be going," murmurs Mum to Dad. "Lara, are you coming?" "Actually, I'll stay out here for a moment," I say on impulse. "See you inside." I wait until my parents have disappeared, then edge closer to Uncle Bill. I've suddenly hatched a demon plan. At his seminar, Uncle Bill said the key to success for any entrepreneur was grabbing every opportunity. Well, I'm an entrepreneur, aren't I? And this is an opportunity, isn't it? When he seems to have finished his conversation, I say hesitantly, "Hi, Uncle Bill. Could I talk to you for a moment?"
"Wait."
He lifts a hand and puts his BlackBerry to his ear.
"Hi, Paolo, what's up?"
His eyes swivel to me and he beckons, which I guess is my cue to speak. "Did you know I'm a headhunter now?" I give a nervous smile. "I've gone into partnership with a friend. We're called L&N Executive Recruitment. Could I tell you about our business?" Uncle Bill frowns at me thoughtfully for a moment, then says,
"Hold on, Paolo."
Oh, wow. He's put his phone call on hold. For me. "We specialise in finding highly qualified, motivated individuals for senior executive positions," I say, trying not to gabble. "I wondered if maybe I could talk with someone in your HR department, explain our services, maybe put a pitch together."
"Lara?"
Uncle Bill lifts a hand to stop me.
What would you say if I put you in touch with my head of recruitment and told her, this is my niece, give her a chance?
I feel an explosion of delight. I want to sing hallelujah. My gamble paid off. I'd say thank you very much, Uncle Bill, I manage, trying to stay calm. I'd do the best job I could. I'd work 24/7. I'd be so grateful.
No,
he interrupts.
You wouldn't. You wouldn't respect yourself.
What? I stop in confusion.
I'm saying no.
He shoots me a dazzling white smile.
I'm doing you a favor, Lara. If you make it on your own, you'll feel so much better. You'll feel you've earned it.
Right. I swallow, my face burning with humiliation. I mean, I do want to earn it. I do want to work hard. I just thought maybe...
If I can come from two little coins, Lara, so can you.
He holds my gaze for a moment.
Believe in yourself. Believe in your dream. Here.
Oh, no, please, no. He's reached in his pocket and is now holding out 2 10-pence pieces to me.
These are your 2 little coins.
He gives me a deep, earnest look, the same way he does on the TV ad.
Lara, close your eyes. Feel it. Believe it. Say, this is my beginning.
This is my beginning, I mumble, cringing all over. Thanks. Uncle Bill nods, then turns back to the phone.
Paolo, sorry about that.
Hot with embarrassment, I edge away. So much for grabbing opportunities. So much for contacts. I just want to get through this stupid funeral and go home. I head around the building and through the front glass doors of the funeral centre to find myself in a foyer with upholstered chairs and posters of doves and a subdued air. There's no one about, not even at the reception desk. Suddenly, I hear singing coming from behind a pale wood door. Shit, it's started. I'm missing it. I hurriedly push the door open, and sure enough, there are rows of benches filled with people. The room is so crowded that, as I edge in, the people standing at the back have to jostle to one side, and I find myself a space as unobtrusively as possible. As I look around, trying to spot Mum and Dad, I'm overwhelmed by the sheer number of people here, and the flowers. All down the sides of the room there are gorgeous arrangements in shades of white and cream. A woman at the front is singing Pied Jésus, but there are so many people in front of me I can't see. Near me, a couple of people are sniffing, and one girl has tears streaming openly down her face. I feel a bit chastened. All these people here for my great-aunt, and I never even knew her. I didn't even send any flowers, I realize in sudden mortification. Should I have written a card or something? God, I hope Mum and Dad sorted it all out. The music is so lovely, and the atmosphere is so emotional, that suddenly I can't help it. I feel my eyes pricking too. Next to me is an old lady in a black velvet hat, who notices and clicks her tongue sympathetically. "Do you have a handkerchief, dear?" she whispers. "No," I admit, and she immediately snaps open her large, old-fashioned patent bag. A smell of camphor rises up, and inside I glimpse several pairs of spectacles, a box of mints, a packet of hairpins, a box labelled string, and half a packet of digestive biscuits. You should always bring a handkerchief to her funeral. She offers me a packet of tissues. Thanks, I gulp, taking one. That's really kind. I'm the great-niece, by the way. She nods sympathetically. This must be a terrible time for you. How's the family coping? Oh, well, I fold up the tissue, wondering how to answer. I can't exactly say, no one's that bothered. In fact, Uncle Bill's still on his BlackBerry outside. We all have to support each other at this time, I improvise at last.
That's it.
The old lady nods gravely as though I've said something really wise, as opposed to straight off a Hallmark card.
We all have to support each other.
She clasps my hand.
I'd be glad to talk, dear, any time you want to. It's an honour to meet any relative of Bert's.
Thank you, I begin automatically, then halt. Bert? I'm sure my aunt wasn't called Bert. In fact, I know she wasn't. She was called Sadie.
You know, you look a lot like him.
The woman surveying my face. Shit! I'm in the wrong funeral.
Something about the forehead. And you have his nose. Did anyone ever tell you that, dear?
Sometimes, I say wildly. Actually, I've just got to, thanks so much for the tissue. I hastily start making my way back toward the door.
It's Bert's great niece.
I can hear the old lady's voice following me.
She's very upset, poor thing.
I practically throw myself at the pale wooden door and find myself in the foyer again, almost landing on Mum and Dad. They're standing with a woman with woolly, grey hair, a dark suit, and a stack of leaflets in her hand.
Lara, where were you?
Mum looks in puzzlement at the door.
What were you doing in there?
Were you in Mr. Cox's funeral?
The grey-haired woman looks taken aback.
I got lost, I say defensively. I didn't know where to go. You should put signs on the doors.
Silently, the woman raises her hand and points at a plastic-lettered sign above the door. Bertram Cox, 1:30 p.m.
Damn! Why didn't I notice that?
Well, anyway, I try to regain my dignity.
Let's go. We need to bag a seat.
Chapter 2. Bag a seat. What a joke. I've never been at anything as depressing as this my whole entire life.
Okay, I know it's a funeral. It's not supposed to be a riot. But at least Bert's funeral had lots of people and flowers and music and atmosphere. At least that other room felt like something.
This room has nothing. It's bare and chilly, with just a closed coffin at the front and Sadie Lancaster in crappy plastic letters on a notice board. No flowers, no lovely smell, no singing, just some muzak piped out of speakers. And the place is practically empty. Just Mum, Dad and me on one side, Uncle Bill, Aunt Trudy and my cousin Diamante on the other. I surreptitiously run my gaze over the other side of the family. Even though we're related, they still seem like a celebrity magazine come to life. Uncle Bill is sprawled on his plastic chair as though he owns the place, typing at his BlackBerry. Aunt Trudy is flicking through Hello, probably reading about all her friends. She's wearing a tight black dress. Her blonde hair is artfully swept around her face, and her cleavage is even more tanned and impressive than last time I saw her. Aunt Trudy married Uncle Bill 20 years ago, and I swear she looks younger today than she does in her wedding pictures. Diamante's platinum blonde hair sweeps down to her bum, and she's wearing a mini dress covered with a skull print. Really tasteful for a funeral. She has her iPod plugged in and is texting on her mobile and keeps looking at her watch with a sulky scowl. Diamante is 17 and has 2 cars and her own fashion label called Tutus and Pearls, which Uncle Bill set up for her. I looked at it online once. The dresses all cost £400 and everyone who buys one gets their name on a special Diamante's Best Friends list, and half of them are celebs' kids. It's like Facebook, but with dresses. Hey, Mum, I say, how come there aren't any flowers?
Oh,
Mum immediately looks anxious. I spoke to Trudy about flowers, and she said she would do it. Trudy, she calls over, what happened about the flowers?
Well,
Trudy closes hello and swivels around as though she's quite up for a chat. I know we discussed it, but you know the price of all this? She gestures around. And we're sitting here for, what, 20 minutes?
You've got to be realistic, Pippa.
Flowers would be a waste. I suppose so, Mum says hesitantly. I mean, I don't begrudge the old lady a funeral. Aunt Trudy leans toward us, lowering her voice. But you have to ask yourself, what did she ever do for us? I mean, I didn't know her, did you?
Well, it was difficult. Mum looks pained. She'd had the stroke. She was bewildered a lot of the time.
Exactly. Trudy nods. She didn't understand anything.
What was the point? It's only because of Bill that we're here.
Trudy glances at Uncle Bill fondly. He's too soft-hearted for his own good.
I often say to people, crap!
Diamante rips out her earphones and looks at her mother scornfully.
We're only here for Dad's show. He wasn't planning to come till the producer said a funeral would massively up his sympathy quotient. I heard them talking.
Diamante! Exclaims Aunt Trudy crossly.
It's true. He's the biggest hypocrite on earth, and so are you. And I'm supposed to be at Hannah's house right now.
Diamante's cheeks puff out resentfully.
Her dad's like having this big party for his new movie, and I'm missing it. Just so Dad can look all family and caring. It's so unfair.
Diamante, says Trudy tartly, it's your father who paid for you and Hannah to go to Barbados, remember? And that boob job you keep talking about, who's paying for that, do you think?
Diamante draws in breath as though mortally offended.
That is so unfair! My boob job's for charity!
I can't help leaning forward with interest. How can a boob job be for charity?
I'm going to do a magazine interview about it afterward and give the proceeds to charity, she says proudly. Like, half the proceeds or something?
I glance at Mum. She looks so speechless with shock I almost burst into giggles.
Hello?
We all look up to see a woman in grey trousers and a clerical collar heading up the aisle toward us.
Many apologies, she says, spreading her hands. I hope you haven't been waiting too long.
She has cropped salt and pepper hair, dark-rimmed glasses, and a deep, almost masculine voice.
My condolences on your loss.
She glances at the bare coffin.
I don't know if you were informed, but it's normal to put up photographs of your loved one.
We all exchange blank, awkward looks. Then Aunt Trudy gives a sudden click of the tongue.
I've got a photo. The nursing home sent it on.
She rummages in her bag and produces a brown envelope, out of which she draws a battered-looking Polaroid. As she passes it over, I take a look. It shows a tiny, wrinkled old lady hunched over in a chair, wearing a shapeless, pale mauve cardigan. Her face is folded over in a million lines. Her white hair is a translucent puff of candy floss. Her eyes are opaque, as though she can't even see the world. So that was my great-aunt Sadie, and I never even met her. The vicar looks at the print dubiously, then pins it onto a big notice board, where it looks totally sad and embarrassing all on its own.
Would any of you like to speak about the deceased?
Mutely we all shake our heads.
I understand. It can often be too painful for close family.
The vicar produces a notebook and pencil from her pocket.
In which case I'll be glad to speak on your behalf. If you could perhaps just give me some details, incidents from her life. Tell me everything about Sadie that we should be celebrating.
There's silence.
We didn't really know her,
Dad says apologetically.
She was very old.
105, Mum puts in. She was 105.
Was she ever married?
The vicar prompts. Dad's brow is wrinkled.
Was there a husband, Bill? Dunno. Yeah, I think there was.
Don't know what it was called, though.
Uncle Bill hasn't even looked from his blackberry.
Can we get on with this?
Of course.
The vicar's sympathetic smile has frozen.
Well, perhaps just some small anecdote from the last time you visited her. Some hobby.
There's another guilty silence.
She's wearing a cardigan in the picture, ventures Mum at last. Maybe she knitted it. Maybe she liked knitting.
Did you never visit her?
The vicar is clearly forcing herself to stay polite.
Of course we did, says Mum defensively. We popped in to see her in,
she thinks, in 1982, I think it was. Lara was a baby.
1982?
The vicar looks scandalised.
She didn't know us,
puts in Dad quickly.
She really wasn't all there.
What about from earlier in her life?
The vicar's voice sounds slightly outraged.
No achievements? Stories from her youth?
Jeez, you don't give up, do you?
Dear Monty rips her iPod speakers out of her ears.
Can't you tell we're only here because we have to be? She didn't do anything special. She didn't achieve anything. She was nobody. Just some million-year-old nobody.
Dear Monte, says Aunt Trudy in mild reproof,
that's not very nice.
It's true, though, isn't it? I mean, look.
She gestures scornfully around the empty room.
If only six people came to my funeral, I'd shoot myself.
Young lady.
The vicar takes a few steps forward, her face flushing with anger.
No human on God's earth is a nobody.
Yeah, whatever,
says Diamante rudely, and I can see the vicar opening her mouth to make another retort.
Diamante!
Uncle Bill lifts a hand quickly.
Enough. Obviously, I myself regret not visiting Sadie, who I'm sure was a very special person, and I'm sure I speak for all of us.
He's so charming I can see the vicar's ruffled feathers being smoothed.
But now what we'd like to do is send her off with dignity. I expect you have a tight schedule, as do we.
He taps his watch.
Indeed, says the vicar after a pause. I'll just prepare. In the meantime, please switch off your mobile phones.
With a last, disapproving look around at us all, she heads out again, and Aunt Trudy immediately turns in her seat.
What a nerve, giving us a guilt trip. We don't have to be here, you know.
The door opens and we all look up, but it's not the vicar. It's Tonya. I didn't know she was coming. This day just got about 100% worse.
Have I missed it?
A pneumatic drill of a voice fills the room as she strides down the aisle.
I just managed to scoot away from toddler Jim before the twins had a meltdown. Honestly, this au pair is worse than the last one, and that's saying something.
She's wearing black trousers and a black cardigan trimmed with leopard print, her thick, highlighted hair pulled back in a ponytail. Tonya used to be an office manager at Shell and boss people around all day. Now she's a full-time mum of twin boys, Lorcan and Declan, and bosses have poor au pairs around instead.
How are the boys?
Asks Mum, but Tonya doesn't notice. She's totally focused on Uncle Bill.
Uncle Bill, I read your book. It was amazing. It changed my life. I've told everyone about it. And the photo is wonderful, although it doesn't do you justice.
Thanks, sweetheart.
Bill shoots her his standard, yes, I know I'm brilliant smile, but she doesn't seem to notice.
Isn't it a fantastic book?
She appeals around to the rest of us.
Isn't Uncle Bill a genius? To start with absolutely nothing. Just two coins and a big dream. It's so inspiring for humanity.
She's such a suck-up I want to hurl. Mum and Dad obviously feel the same way, as neither of them answers. Uncle Bill isn't paying her any attention either. Reluctantly, she swivels around on her heel.
How are you, Lara? I've hardly seen you lately. You've been hiding.
Her eyes start focusing in on me with intent as she comes nearer, and I shrink away. Uh-oh, I know that look. My sister Tonya basically has three facial expressions. One, totally blank and bovine. Two, loud, showy, offy laughter, as in, Uncle Bill, you kill me. Three, gloating delight masked as sympathy as she picks away at someone else's misery. She's addicted to the Real Life channel and books with tragic, scruffy kids on the cover called things like, Please, Grammy, don't hit me with the mangle. I haven't seen you since you split up with Josh. What a shame. You two seemed so perfect together. Tonya tilts her head sorrowfully. Didn't they seem perfect together, Mum? Well, it didn't work out. I try to sound matter-of-fact. So, anyway, what went wrong? She gives me that doe-eyed, fake, concerned look she gets when something bad happens to another person and she's really, really enjoying it. These things happen, I shrug. But they don't, though, do they? There's always a reason. Tonya is relentless. Didn't he say anything?
Tonya,
Dad puts in gently,
is this the best time?
Dad, I'm just supporting Lara, Tonya says in affront. It's always best to talk these things through. So, was there someone else? Her eyes swivel back to me. I don't think so. Were you getting on okay? Yes. Then why? She folds her arms, looking baffled and almost accusing. Why? I don't know why, I want to scream. Don't you think I've asked myself that question a bazillion times? It was just one of those things. I force a smile. I'm fine about it. I realize that it wasn't meant to be, and I've moved on, and I'm in a good place. I'm really happy. You don't look happy, Diamante observes from across the aisle. Does she, Mum? Aunt Trudy surveys me for a few moments. No, she says at last, in definitive tones. She doesn't look happy. Well, I am. I can feel tears stinging my eyes. I'm just hiding it. I'm really, really, really happy. God, I hate all my relatives. Tonya, darling, sit down, Mum says tactfully. How did the school visit go? Blinking hard, I get out my phone and pretend to be checking my messages so no one bothers me. Then, before I can stop it, my finger scrolls down to photos. Don't look, I tell myself firmly. Do not look. But my fingers won't obey me. It's an overwhelming compulsion. I have to have one quick look, just to keep me going. My fingers are scrabbling as I summon up my favourite picture. Josh and me, standing together on a mountain slope, arms around each other, both with ski tans. Josh's fair hair is curling over the goggles thrust up on his head. He's smiling at me with that perfect dimple in his cheek. That dimple I used to push my finger into, like a toddler with Play-Doh. We first met at a Guy Fawkes party, standing around a fire in a garden in Clapham that belonged to a girl I knew at university. Josh was handing out sparklers to everyone. He lit one for me and asked me what my name was and wrote Lara in the darkness with his sparkler, and I laughed and asked his name. We wrote each other's names in the air until the sparklers went dead, then edged closer to the fire and sipped mulled wine and reminisced about fireworks parties of our childhoods. Everything we said chimed. We laughed at the same things. I'd never met anyone so easygoing, or with such a cute smile. I can't imagine him being with anyone else. I just can't.
All right, Lara.
Dad is glancing over at me. Yes, I say brightly, and jab off the phone before he can see the screen. As organ music begins, I sink back in my chair, consumed with misery. I should never have come today. I should have made up an excuse. I hate my family, and I hate funerals, and there isn't even any good coffee, and where's my necklace? A girl's distant voice interrupts my thoughts. I glance around to see who it is, but there's no one behind me. Who was that? Where's my necklace? The faint voice comes again. It's high and imperious and quite posh-sounding. Is it coming from the phone? Didn't I turn it off properly? I pull my phone out of my bag, but the screen is dead. Weird.
Where's my necklace?
Now the voice sounds as though it's right in my ear. I flinch and look all around in bewilderment. What's even weirder is, no one else seems to have noticed. Mum, I lean over. Did you hear something just now? Like a voice?
A voice?
Mum looks puzzled.
No, darling. What kind of voice?
It was a girl's voice just a moment ago. I stop as I see a familiar look of anxiety coming over Mum's face. I can almost see her thoughts in a bubble. Dear God, my daughter's hearing voices in her head. I must have misheard, I say hastily, and thrust my phone away just as the vicar appears.
Please rise,
she intones,
and let us all bow our heads. Dear Lord, we commend to you the soul of our sister Sadie.
I'm not being prejudiced, but this vicar has the most monotonous voice in the existence of mankind. We're 5 minutes in, and I've already given up trying to pay attention. It's like school assembly. Your mind just goes numb. I lean back and stare up at the ceiling and tune out. I'm just letting my eyelids close when I hear the voice again right in my ear.
Where's my necklace?
That made me jump. I swivel my head around from side to side, but again there's nothing. What's wrong with me? Lara, Mum whispers in alarm, are you okay? I've just got a bit of a headache, I hiss back. I might go and sit by the window, get some air. Gesturing apologetically, I get up and head to a chair near the back of the room. The vicar barely notices. She's too engrossed in her speech.
The end of life is the beginning of life. For as we came from earth, so we return to earth.
Where's my necklace? I need it.
Sharply, I turn my head from side to side, hoping to catch the voice this time. And then, suddenly, I see it. A hand. A slim, manicured hand, resting on the chair back in front of me. I move my eyes along incredulously. The hand belongs to a long, pale, sinuous arm, which belongs to a girl about my age, who's lounging on a chair in front of me, her fingers drumming impatiently. She has dark, bobbed hair and a silky, sleeveless, pale green dress, and I can just glimpse a pale, jutting chin. I'm too astonished to do anything except gape. Who the hell is that? As I watch, she swings herself off the chair as though she can't bear to sit still and starts to pace up and down. Her dress falls straight to the knee, with little pleats at the bottom, which swish about as she walks. I need it, she's muttering in agitation. Where is it? Where is it? Her voice has a clipped, pinched accent, just like in old-fashioned black-and-white films. I glance wildly over at the rest of my family, but no one else has noticed her. No one has even heard her voice. Everyone else is sitting quietly. Suddenly, as though she senses my gaze on her, the girl wheels around and fixes her eyes on mine. They're so dark and glittering, I can't tell what colour they are, but they widen incredulously as I stare back. Okay. I'm starting to panic here. I'm having a hallucination. A full-on, walking, talking hallucination. And it's coming toward me.
You can see me.
She points a white finger at me, and I shrink back in my seat.
You can see me.
I shake my head quickly. I can't.
And you can hear me.
No, I can't. I'm aware of Mum at the front of the room, turning to frown at me. Quickly, I cough and gesture at my chest. When I turn back, the girl has gone. Vanished. Thank God for that. I thought I was going crazy. I mean, I know I've been stressed out recently, but to have an actual vision.
Who are you?
I nearly jump out of my skin as the girl's voice punctuates my thoughts again. Now, suddenly, she's striding down the aisle toward me.
Who are you?
She demands. Where is this? Who are these people? Do not reply to the hallucination. I tell myself firmly. It'll only encourage it. I swivel my head away and try to pay attention to the vicar.
Who are you?
The girl has suddenly appeared right in front of me. Are you real? She raises a hand as though to prod my shoulder, and I cringe away. But her hand swishes straight through me and comes out the other side. I gasp in shock. The girl stares in bewilderment at her hand, then at me.
What are you?
She demands.
Are you a dream? Me?
I can't help retorting in an indignant undertone. Of course I'm not a dream. You're the dream.
I'm not a dream.
She sounds equally indignant. Who are you, then? I can't help shooting back. Immediately I regret it, as Mum and Dad both glance back at me. If I told them I was talking to a hallucination, they'd flip. I'd be incarcerated in the Priory tomorrow. The girl juts her chin out.
I'm Sadie. Sadie Lancaster.
Sadie? No. No way. I can't quite move. My eyes are flicking madly from the girl in front of me to the wizened, candy-floss-haired old woman in the Polaroid, and then back again to the girl. I'm hallucinating my dead 105-year-old great-aunt. The hallucination girl looks fairly freaked out, too. She turns and starts looking around the room, as though taking it in for the first time. For a dizzying few seconds, she appears and reappears all over the room, examining every corner, every window, like an insect buzzing around a glass tank. I've never had an imaginary friend. I've never taken drugs. What is up with me? I tell myself to ignore the girl, to blank her out, to pay attention to the vicar. But it's no good. I can't help following her progress.
What is this place?
She's hovering by me now, her eyes narrowing in suspicion. She's focusing on the coffin at the front.
What's that?
Oh, God.
That's nothing, I say hastily. Nothing at all. It's just... I mean, I wouldn't look too closely if I were you.
Too late. She's appeared at the coffin, staring down at it. I can see her reading the name Sadie Lancaster on the plastic notice board. I can see her face jolt in shock. After a few moments she turns toward the vicar, who is still droning on in her monotone.
Sadie found contentment in marriage, which can be an inspiration to us all.
The girl puts her face right up close to the vicar's and regards her with disdain.
You fool, she says scathingly. She was a woman who lived to a great age.
The vicar carries on, totally oblivious.
I look at this picture.
She gestures at the photo with an understanding smile.
And I see a woman who, despite her infirmity, led a beautiful life, who found solace in small things. Knitting, for example.
Knitting?
The girl echoes incredulously.
So,
the vicar has obviously finished her speech.
Let us all bow our heads for a final moment of silence before we say farewell.
She steps down from the podium and some organ music begins.
What happens now?
The girl looks around, suddenly alert. A moment later she's by my side.
What happens now? Tell me! Tell me!
Well, the coffin goes behind that curtain, I murmur in an undertone, and then, I trail off, consumed by embarrassment. How do I put it tactfully?
We're at a crematorium, you see, so that would mean...
I wheel my hands vaguely. The girl's face blanches with shock, and I watch in discomfiture as she starts fading to a weird, pale, translucent state. It almost seems as if she's fainting, but even more so. For a moment I can almost see right through her. Then, as though making some inner resolution, she comes back.
No,
she shakes her head. That can't happen. I need my necklace. I need it. Sorry, I say helplessly.
Nothing I can do.
You have to stop the funeral.
She suddenly looks up, her eyes dark and glittering.
What?
I stare at her.
I can't. You can. Tell them to stop.
As I turn away, trying to tune her out, she appears at my other side.
Stand up! Say something!
Her voice is as insistent and piercing as a toddler's. I'm frantically ducking my head in all directions, trying to avoid her.
Stop the funeral! Stop it! I must have my necklace!
She's an inch away from my face. Her fists are banging on my chest. I can't feel them, but I still flinch. In desperation, I get to my feet and move back a row, knocking over a chair with a clatter.
Lara, are you all right?
Mum looks back in alarm.
Fine,
I manage, trying to ignore the yelling in my ear as I sink down into another seat.
I'll order the car,
Uncle Bill is saying to Aunt Trudy.
This should be over in 5.
Stop it! Stop it! Stop it! Stop it!
The girl's voice rises to the most penetrating shriek, like feedback in my ear. I'm going schizophrenic. Now I know why people assassinate presidents. There's no way I can ignore her. She's like a banshee. I can't stand this any longer. I'm clutching my head, trying to block her out, but it's no good.
Stop! Stop! You have to stop!
Okay, okay, just shut up. In desperation, I get to my feet.
Wait,
I shout.
Stop, everybody. You have to stop the funeral. Stop the funeral!
To my relief, the girl stops shrieking. On the downside, my entire family has turned to gape at me as if I'm a lunatic. The vicar presses a button in a wooden panel set in the wall, and the organ music abruptly stops.
Stop the funeral,
says Mum at last. I nod silently. I don't feel quite in control of my faculties, to be honest.
But why?
I clear my throat. I don't think it's the right time for her to go.
Lara.
Dad sighs.
I know you're under strain at the moment, but really...
He turns to the vicar.
I do apologize. My daughter hasn't been quite herself lately. Boyfriend trouble,
he mouths.
This is nothing to do with that,
I protest indignantly, but everyone ignores me.
Ah, I understand.
The vicar nods sympathetically.
Lara, we'll finish the funeral now,
she says, as though I'm a 3-year-old.
And then perhaps you and I will have a cup of tea together
and a little talk.
How about that?
She presses the button again, and the organ music resumes. A moment later, the coffin starts moving creakily away on its plinth, disappearing behind the curtain. Behind me, I hear a sharp gasp. Then,
no!
Comes a howl of anguish.
No! Stop! You have to stop!
To my horror, the girl runs up onto the plinth and starts trying to push the coffin back. But her arms don't work. They keep sinking through.
Please?
She looks up and addresses me desperately.
Don't let them.
I'm starting to feel a genuine panic here. I don't know why I'm hallucinating this or what it means, but it feels real. Her torment looks real. I can't just sit back and witness this.
No,
I shout.
Stop!
Lara, Mum begins. I mean it. There's a just cause and impediment why this coffin cannot be fried. You have to stop, now. I hurry down the aisle.
Press that button or I'll do it myself.
Looking flustered, the vicar presses the button again, and the coffin comes to a standstill.
Dear, perhaps you should wait outside.
She's showing off as usual,
says Tonya impatiently.
Just cause an impediment. I mean, how on earth could there be? Just get on with it.
She bossily addresses the vicar, who bristles slightly.
Lara?
She ignores Tonya and turns to me.
Do you have a reason for wanting to stop your great-aunt's funeral?
Yes.
And that is?
She pauses questioningly. Oh, God, what am I supposed to say? Because a hallucination told me to?
It's because... Say I was murdered.
I look up in shock to see the girl right in front of me.
Say it.
Then they'll have to put off the funeral.
Say it!
She's beside me, shouting in my ear again.
Say it! Say it, say it, say it!
I think my aunt was murdered, I blurt out in desperation. I have seen my family looking at me, gobsmacked, on a number of occasions in my time, but nothing has ever provoked a reaction like this. They're all turned in their seats, their jaws hanging in incomprehension like some kind of still-life painting. I almost want to laugh.
Murdered?
Says the vicar at last.
Yes, I say forthrightly. I have reason to believe there was foul play, so we need to keep the body for evidence.
Slowly the vicar walks toward me, narrowing her eyes, as though trying to gauge exactly how much of a time-waster I am. What she doesn't know is, I used to play staring matches with Tonya, and I always won. I gaze back, perfectly matching her grave, this is no laughing matter expression.
Murdered?
How? She says. I'd rather discuss that with the authorities, I shoot back, as though I'm in an episode of CSI Funeral Home.
You want me to call the police?
She's looking genuinely shocked now.
Oh, God, of course I don't want her to call the bloody police.
But I can't backtrack now. I have to act convincing.
Yes, I say after a pause. Yes, I think that would be best.
You can't be taking her seriously,
Tonya explodes.
It's obvious she's just trying to cause a sensation.
I can tell the vicar is getting a bit pissed off with Tonya, which is quite useful for me.
My dear, she says curtly, that decision does not rest with you. Any accusation like this has to be followed up, and your sister is quite right. The body would have to be preserved for forensics.
I think the vicar's getting into this. She probably watches TV murder mysteries every Sunday evening. Sure enough, she comes even farther toward me and says in a low voice,
"Who do you think murdered your great-aunt?"
I'd rather not comment at this time, I say darkly. It's complicated. I shoot a significant look at Tonya. If you know what I mean.
What?
Tonya's face starts turning pink with outrage.
You're not accusing me.
I'm not saying anything. I adopt an inscrutable air. Except to the police.
This is bullshit. Are we finishing this or not?
Uncle Bill puts his blackberry away.
Because, either way, my car's here, and we've given this old lady enough time already.
More than enough, chimes in Aunt Trudy. Come on, dear Monty. This is a farce.
With cross, impatient gestures, she begins to gather up her celebrity magazines.
Laura, I don't know what the hell you're playing at.
Uncle Bill scowls at Dad as he passes.
She needs help, your daughter. Bloody lunatic.
Laura, darling.
Mum gets out of her seat and comes over, her brow crinkled in worry.
You didn't even know your great-aunt Sadie.
Maybe I didn't. Maybe I did. I fold my arms. There's a lot I don't tell you. I'm almost starting to believe in this murder. The vicar is looking flustered now, as though this is all getting out of her league.
I think I'd better call the police. Laura, if you wait here, I think everyone else should probably leave. Laura.
Dad comes over and takes my arm.
Darling.
Dad, just go. I muster a noble misunderstood air. I have to do what I have to do. I'll be fine. Shooting me various looks of alarm, outrage, and pity, my family slowly files out of the room, followed by the vicar. I'm left alone in the silent room, and it's as if the spell has suddenly broken. What the bloody hell did I just do? Am I going mad? Actually, it would explain a lot. Maybe I should just get admitted to some nice, peaceful mental home where you do drawing in a jumpsuit and don't have to think about your failing business or ex-boyfriend or parking tickets. I sink into a chair and exhale. At the front of the room, the hallucination girl has appeared in front of the notice board, staring at the photo of the little, hunched old woman. "So, were you murdered?" I can't help saying. "Oh, I shouldn't think so." She's barely acknowledged me, let alone said thank you. Trust me to have a vision with no manners. "Well, you're welcome," I say moodily. "You know, any time." The girl doesn't even seem to hear. She's peering around the room as if she doesn't understand something. "Where are all the flowers? If this is my funeral, where are the flowers?" "Oh," I feel a squeeze of guilt. "The flowers were put somewhere else by mistake. There were lots, honestly. Really gorgeous." "She's not real," I tell myself fervently. "This is just my own guilty conscience speaking." "And what about the people?" She sounds perplexed. "Where were all the people?" "Some of them couldn't come." I cross my fingers behind my back, hoping I sound convincing. "Loads wanted to, though." I stop as she disappears into thin air, right as I'm talking to her. "Where's my necklace?" I jump in fright as her voice comes urgently in my ear again. "I don't know where your bloody necklace is," I exclaim. "Stop bugging me. You realize I'll never live this down, and you haven't even said thank you." There's silence, and she tilts her face away, like a caught-out child. "Thank you," she says at last. "It's okay." The hallucination girl is fidgeting with a metal snake bracelet entwined around her wrist, and I find myself eyeing her more closely. Her hair is dark and shiny, and the tips frame her face as she tilts her head forward. She has a long, white neck, and now I can see that her huge, luminous eyes are green. Her cream leather shoes are tiny, size 4 maybe, with little buttons and Cuban heels. I'd say she's about my age, maybe even younger. "Uncle Bill," she says at last, twisting the bracelet around and around. "William, one of Virginia's boys." "Yes, Virginia was my grandmother. My dad is Michael, which makes you my great-aunt." I break off and clutch my head. This is crazy. How do I even know what you look like? How can I be hallucinating you? "You're not hallucinating me." She jerks her chin up, looking offended. "I'm real." "You can't be real," I say impatiently. "You're dead. So what are you, then? A ghost?" There's a weird beat of silence. Then the girl looks away. "I don't believe in ghosts," she says disparagingly. "Nor do I." I match her tone. "No way." The door opens and I start in shock. "Lara." The vicar comes in, her face pink and flustered. "I've spoken to the police. They'd like you to come down to the station." Chapter 3. It turns out they take murder quite seriously at police stations, which I suppose I should have guessed. They've put me in a little room with a table and plastic chairs and posters about locking your car. They've given me a cup of tea and a form to fill in, and a policewoman told me a detective would be along in a moment to talk to me. I want to laugh hysterically, or climb out the window. "What am I going to say to a detective?" I exclaim, as soon as the door has closed. "I don't know anything about you. How am I going to say you were murdered? With the candlestick in the drawing room?" Sadie doesn't even seem to have heard me. She's sitting on the window ledge, swinging her legs, although when I look more closely, I notice that she's not actually on the ledge. She's floating about an inch above it. Following my gaze, she sees the gap and flinches with annoyance. She adjusts her position carefully until she looks as though she's sitting right on the ledge, then insouciantly starts swinging her legs again. "She's all in my mind," I tell myself firmly. "Let's be rational here. If my own brain has conjured her up, then my own brain can get rid of her." "Go away," I think as strongly as I can, holding my breath and clenching my fists. "Go away, go away, go away!"
Sadie glances over me and gives a sudden giggle.
"You do look peculiar," she says.
"Do you have a pain in your stomach?" I'm about to make a retort when the door opens, and my stomach really does twinge. It's a detective, wearing plain clothes, which makes it almost more scary than if he was in uniform. Oh, God, I am in such trouble.
Laura.
The detective holds out his hand. He's tall and broad, with dark hair and a brisk manner.
D.I. James.
Hi.
My voice is squeaky with nerves.
Nice to meet you.
So?
He sits down in a businesslike way and takes out a pen.
I understand you stopped your great-aunt's funeral.
That's right.
I nod with as much conviction as I can muster. I just think there was something suspicious about her death. D.I. James makes a note, then looks up.
Why?
I stare blankly back at him, my heart pounding. I have no answer. I should have made something up very quickly. I'm an idiot.
Well, don't you think it suspicious? I improvise at last. Her just dying like that?
I mean, people don't just die out of the blue. D.I. James regards me with an unreadable expression.
I believe she was 105 years old.
So what? I retort, gaining confidence. Can't people of 105 be murdered too?
I didn't think the police were so ageist. D.I. James's face flickers, whether with amusement or annoyance I can't tell.
Who do you think murdered your great-aunt?
He says.
It was...
I rub my nose, playing for time.
It's rather complicated.
I glance helplessly up at Sadie.
You're useless, she cries. You need a story or they won't believe you. They won't delay the funeral any longer. Say it was the staff at the nursing home. Say you heard them plotting.
No, I exclaim in shock before I can help myself. D.I. James gives me an odd look and clears his throat.
Laura, do you have a genuine reason for believing something was amiss with your great-aunt's death?
Say it was the staff at the nursing home!
Sadie's voice is in my ear like a screeching brake.
Say it! Say it! Say it! It was the staff at the nursing home, I blurt out in desperation. I think.
What grounds do you have for saying this?
D.I. James's tone is even, but his eyes are alert. In front of him, Sadie is hovering, glowering at me and wheeling her hands around as though to crank the words out of me. The sight is totally freaking me out.
I overheard them whispering in the pub. Something about poison and insurance. I thought nothing of it at the time.
I swallow feebly.
But the next moment, my great-aunt's dead.
I've lifted this entire plot from a daytime soap opera that I watched last month when I was off sick, I abruptly realize. D.I. James gives me a penetrating look.
You would testify to this?
Oh, God. Testify is one of those very scary words, like tax inspector and lumbar puncture. I cross my fingers under the table and gulp.
Yes.
Did you see these people?
No.
What's the name of the nursing home? What area is it in?
I stare back at him steadily. I have no idea. I glance up at Sadie, who has her eyes closed, as though recalling something from a long, long way away.
Fairside, she says slowly, in Potter's Bar.
Fairside, Potter's Bar, I repeat. There's a short silence. D.I. James has finished writing and is flicking his pen backward and forward.
I'm just going to consult with a colleague.
He stands up.
I'll be back in a minute.
The moment he's left the room, Sadie gives me a contemptuous look.
Is that the best you could do? He'll never believe you. You were supposed to be helping me. By accusing random people of murder.
Don't be such a goose, she says dismissively. You didn't accuse anyone by name. In fact, your story was utterly hopeless. Poison? Whispered conversations in pubs?
You try making something up on the spot, I reply defensively. And that's not the point. The point is we need to delay my funeral. She's suddenly about 2 inches away from me, her eyes intense and pleading. It can't happen. You can't let it. Not yet. But I blink in surprise as she disappears right before my eyes. God, this is annoying. I feel like I'm Alice in Wonderland. Any minute she'll reappear with a flamingo under her arm, shouting, "Off with her head!" Leaning gingerly back in my chair, half expecting that to disappear too, I blink a few times, trying to process everything. But it's too surreal. I'm sitting in a police station, inventing a murder, being bossed around by a non-existent phantom girl. I never even got any lunch, it occurs to me. Maybe this is all due to low blood sugar. Maybe I'm diabetic and this is the first sign. My mind feels like it's tying itself up in knots. Nothing makes any sense. There's no point trying to work out what's going on. I'll just have to go with the flow. They're going to pursue it. Sadie appears again, speaking so fast I can barely follow her. They think you're probably deluded, but they're going to follow it up anyway, just in case. Really? I say incredulously. That policeman's been talking to another policeman, she explains breathlessly. I followed them. He showed him your notes and said, "Got a right one here." A right one? I can't help echoing indignantly. Sadie ignores me. But then they started talking about some other nursing home where there was a murder. Sounds too ghastly. And one policeman said maybe they should put in a phone call just in case, and the other agreed. So we're all right. All right. You may be all right, but I'm not. As the door swings open, Sadie adds quickly, "Ask the policeman what's going to be done about the funeral. Ask him, ask him." "That's not my problem," I begin, then hastily stop as D.I. James's head appears around the door.
"Laura, I'm going to ask a detective constable to take a statement from you. Then we'll decide how to progress."
Thanks. I'm aware of Sadie glaring meaningfully at me. "And what will happen to..." I hesitate. "How does it work with the body?"
"The body will be kept at the mortuary for now. If we decide to proceed with an investigation, it will remain there until we file a report to the coroner, who will demand an inquest, should the evidence be sufficiently credible and consistent."
He nods briskly, then heads out. As the door closes, I subside. I'm suddenly feeling shaky all over. I've invented a murder story to a real policeman. This is the worst thing I've ever done. Even worse than the time I ate half a packet of biscuits aged 8, and rather than confess to Mum, hid the whole biscuit tin in the garden behind the rose bush and had to watch her search the kitchen for it. "You realize I've just committed perjury," I say to Sadie. "You realize they might arrest me?" "They might arrest me," Sadie echoes mockingly. She's perched on the window ledge again. "Have you never been arrested before?" "Of course I haven't," I goggle at her. "Have you?" "Several times," she says airily. "The first time was for dancing in the village fountain one night. It was too funny." She starts to giggle. "We had some mock handcuffs, you know, as part of a fancy dress costume. And while the policeman was hauling me out of the pond, my friend Bunty locked her handcuffs round him as a lock. He was livid." She's in paroxysms of laughter by now. God, she's annoying. "I'm sure it was hilarious." I shoot her a baleful look. "But personally, I'd rather not go to jail and catch some hideous disease, thank you." "Well, you wouldn't have to if you had a better story." Her laughter stops. "I've never seen such a ninny. You weren't credible or consistent. At this rate, they won't even proceed with the investigation. We won't have any time." "Time for what?" "Time to find my necklace, of course." I drop my head down on the table with a clunk. She doesn't give up, does she? "Look," I say at last, raising my head an inch, "why do you need this necklace so badly? Why this one particular necklace? Was it a present or something?"
For a moment she's silent, her eyes distant. The only movement in the room is her feet, swinging rhythmically back and forth. "It was a present from my parents for my 21st birthday," she says at last. "I was happy when I wore it." "Well, that's nice," I say, "but I had it all my life. I wore it all my life." She sounds suddenly agitated. "No matter what else I lost, I kept that. It's the most important thing I ever had. I need it." She's fidgeting with her hands, her face tilted down so all I can see is the corner of her chin. She's so thin and pale, she looks like a drooping flower. I feel a pang of sympathy for her, and am about to say, "Of course I'll find your necklace," when she yawns elaborately, stretching her skinny arms above her head, and says, "This is too dull. I wish we could go to a nightclub." I glare at her, all my sympathy gone. Is this the gratitude I get? "If you're so bored," I say, "we can go and finish your funeral if you like." Sadie claps her hand over her mouth and gasps. "You wouldn't." "I might." A knock at the door interrupts us, and a jolly-looking woman in a dark shirt and trousers puts her head around it. "Lara Lington." An hour later, I finished giving my so-called statement. I've never had such a traumatic experience in my life. What a shambles. First, I forgot the name of the nursing home. Then I got my timings all wrong and had to convince the policewoman it had taken me 5 minutes to walk half a mile. I ended up saying I was training to be a professional speed walker. Just thinking about it makes me cringy and hot. There's no way she believed me. I mean, do I look like a professional speed walker? Then I said I'd been to my friend Linda's before visiting the pub. I don't even have a friend called Linda. I just didn't want to mention any of my real friends. She wanted Linda's surname, and I blurted out Davis before I could stop myself. Of course, I'd read it off the top of the form. She was D.C. Davis. At least I didn't say Kaiser Soze. To her credit, the policewoman didn't flicker. Nor did she say whether they would proceed with the case. She just thanked me politely and found me the number of a cab firm. I'll probably go to jail now. Great. All I need. I glower at Sadie, who's lying full length on the desk, staring up at the ceiling. It really didn't help having her in my ear the whole time, constantly correcting me and adding suggestions, and reminiscing about the time two policemen tried to stop her and Bunty racing their motors over the fields and couldn't catch up with them. It was too funny. "You're welcome," I say. "Again."
"Thank you."
Sadie's voice drifts idly over. "Right, well," I pick up my bag. "I'm off." In one quick movement, Sadie sits up.
"You won't forget my necklace, will you?"
"I doubt I will, my entire life." I roll my eyes. "However hard I try." Suddenly she's in front of me, blocking my way to the door.
"No one can see me except you. No one else can help me. Please."
"Look, you can't just say, 'Find my necklace,'" I exclaim in exasperation. "I don't know anything about it. I don't know what it looks like."
"It's made of glass beads with rhinestones," she says eagerly. "It falls to here."
She gestures at her waist.
"The clasp is inlaid mother of pearl."
"Right," I cut her off. "Well, I haven't seen it. If it turns up, I'll let you know." I swing past her, push the door open into the police station foyer, and take out my phone. The foyer is brightly lit, with a grubby linoleum floor and a desk, which right now is empty. Two huge guys in hoodies are having a loud argument while a policeman is trying to calm them down, and I back away to what looks like a safe corner. I get out the minicab firm number D.C. Davies gave me and start keying it into my phone. I can see there are about 20 voice messages on there, but I ignore them all. It'll just be Mum and Dad, stressing away.
"Hey!"
A voice interrupts me and I pause midway through.
"Lara, is that you?"
A guy with sandy hair in a polo neck and jeans is waving at me.
It's me, Mark Phillipson. Sixth Form College.
Mark! I exclaim, suddenly recognizing him. Oh, my God! How are you doing? The only thing I remember about Mark is him playing bass guitar in the college band.
I'm fine. Great.
He comes across with a concerned expression.
What are you doing at the police station? Is everything okay?
Oh, yes, I'm fine. I'm just here for a, you know. I wave it off. Murder thing.
Murder?
He looks staggered. Yeah, but it's no big deal. I mean, obviously it is a big deal. I correct myself hastily at his expression. I'd better not say too much about it. Anyway, how are you doing?
Great. Married to Anna. Remember her?
He flashes a silver wedding ring.
Trying to make it as a painter. I do this stuff on the side.
You're a policeman, I say disbelievingly, and he laughs.
Police artist. People describe the villains. I draw them. It pays the rent. So, how about you, Laura? Are you married? With somebody?
For a moment, I just stare back with a rictor smile. I was with this guy for a while, I say at last. It didn't work out. But I'm fine about it now. I'm in a really good place, actually. I've clenched my plastic cup so hard it's cracked. Mark looks a bit disconcerted.
Well, see you, Laura.
He lifts a hand.
Will you be okay getting home?
I'm calling a cab. I nod. Thanks. Nice to bump into you. Don't let him go. Sadie's voice in my ear makes me jump out of my skin. He can help. Shut up and leave me alone, I mutter out of the corner of my mouth, shooting an even brighter smile at Mark. Bye, Mark. Give my love to Anna. He can draw the necklace. Then you'll know what you're looking for. She's suddenly right in front of me. Ask him quickly. No. Ask him! Her banshee voice is coming back, piercing my eardrum. Ask him, ask him, ask him! Oh, for God's sake, she's going to drive me insane. Mark! I call, so loudly that the two guys in hoodies stop fighting and stare at me. I've got this tiny favour to ask you, if you have a moment.
Sure.
Mark shrugs. We go into a side room with cups of tea from the machine. We pull up chairs to a table, and Mark gets out his paper and artist's pencils.
So?
He raises his eyebrows.
A necklace. That's a new one.
I saw it once at an antiques fair, I improvise, and I'd love to commission one like it, but I'm so bad at drawing things, and it suddenly occurred to me that maybe you could help.
No problem. Fire away.
Mark takes a sip of tea, his pencil poised over the paper, and I glance up at Sadie. It was made of beads, she says, holding up her hands as though she can almost feel it. Two rows of glass beads, almost translucent. It's two rows of beads, I say, almost translucent.
Uh-huh.
He nods, already sketching circular beads.
Like this?
More oval, says Sadie, peering over his shoulder. Longer, and there were rhinestones in between. The beads were more oval, I say apologetically, with rhinestones in between.
No problem.
Mark is already rubbing out and sketching longer beads.
Like this?
I glance up at Sadie. She's watching him, mesmerized. And the dragonfly, she murmurs. You mustn't forget the dragonfly. For another 5 minutes, Mark sketches, rubs out and sketches again, as I relay Sadie's comments. Slowly, gradually, the necklace comes alive on the page. That's it, says Sadie at last. Her eyes are shining as she gazes down. That's my necklace. Perfect, I say to Mark. You've got it. For a moment, we all survey it in silence.
Nice,
says Mark at last, jerking his head at it.
Unusual. Reminds me of something.
He frowns at the sketch for a moment, then shakes his head.
No, lost it.
He glances at his watch.
I'm afraid I have to dash.
That's fine, I say quickly. Thanks so much. When he's gone, I pick up the paper and look at the necklace. It's very pretty, I have to admit. Long rows of glassy beads, sparkling rhinestones, and a big ornamental pendant in the shape of a dragonfly, studded with even more rhinestones. So this is what we're looking for. Yes. Sadie looks up, her face full of animation. Exactly. Where shall we start? You have to be joking. I reach for my jacket and stand up. I'm not looking for anything now. I'm going home and having a nice glass of wine. And then I'm having a chicken korma with naan. Newfangled modern food, I explain, noticing her bemused expression. And then I'm going to bed. So what shall I do? Says Sadie, looking suddenly deflated. I don't know. I head out of the side room back into the foyer. A taxi is offloading an elderly couple onto the pavement outside, and I hurry out calling, Taxi! Can you take me to Kilburn? As the taxi moves off, I spread out the sketch on my lap and look at the necklace again, trying to imagine it in real life. Sadie described the beads as a kind of pale yellow iridescent glass. Even in the drawing, the rhinestones are sparkling all over. The real thing must be stunning. Worth a bit, too. Just for a moment, I feel a flicker of excitement at the thought of actually finding it. But an instant later, sanity checks back into my brain. I mean, it probably doesn't exist. And even if it did, the chances of finding some random necklace belonging to a dead old lady who probably lost it or broke it years ago are approximately 3 million to 1. No, 3 billion to 1. At last I fold the paper and tuck it in my bag, then flop back on my seat. I don't know where Sadie is, and I don't care. I close my eyes, ignoring the constant vibrations of my mobile phone, and let myself doze off. What a day! Chapter 4. The next day, the sketch of the necklace is all I have left. Sadie has disappeared, and the whole episode feels like a dream. At 8:30, I'm sitting at my desk, sipping coffee and staring down at the picture. What on earth got into me yesterday? The entire thing must have been my brain cracking up under the strain. The necklace, the girl, the banshee wailing. It was obviously all a figment of my imagination. For the first time, I'm starting to sympathize with my parents. I'm worried about me, too. Hi! There's a crash, as Kate, our assistant, swings open the door, knocking over a bunch of files, which I'd put on the floor while I got the milk out of the fridge. We don't have the biggest office in the world. So, how was the funeral? Kate hangs up her coat, leaning right back over the photocopier to reach her hook. Luckily, she's quite gymnastic. Not great. In fact, I ended up at the police station. I had this weird mental flip-out. God! Kate looks horrified. Are you okay? Yeah, I mean, I think so. I have to get a grip. Abruptly, I fold up the necklace sketch, thrust it into my bag and zip it shut. Actually, I knew something was up. Kate pauses halfway through twisting her blonde hair into an elastic. Your dad called yesterday afternoon and asked me if you'd been particularly stressed recently. I look up in alarm. You didn't tell him about Natalie leaving? No, of course not. Kate has been well trained in what to divulge to my parents, i.e. nothing. Anyway, I say with more vigour, never mind. I'm fine now. Were there any messages? Yes. Kate reaches for her notebook with a super efficient manner. Shireen kept calling all yesterday. She's going to call you today. Great! Shireen is our one piece of good news at LNN Executive Recruitment. We recently placed her as operations director at a software company, Macrosant. In fact, she's about to start the job next week. She's probably just calling to thank us. Anything else? I say, just as the phone rings. Kate checks the caller ID and her eyes widen. Oh, yes, another thing, she says hurriedly. Janet from Leonidas Sports called, wanting an update. She said she was going to ring at 9 a.m. sharp. This'll be her. She meets my panicky eyes. Do you want me to answer? No, I want to hide under the desk. Yes, you'd better. My stomach is bubbling with nerves. Leonidas Sports is our biggest client. They're a massive sports equipment company with shops all over the UK, and we've promised to find them a marketing director. Rephrase that. Natalie promised to find them a marketing director. I'll just put you through, Kate is saying in her best PA voice, and a moment later the phone on my desk rings. I glance desperately at Kate, then pick it up. Janet, I exclaim in my most confident tones. Good to hear from you. I was just about to call.
Hi, Lara,
comes Janet Grady's familiar, hoarse voice.
Just phoning for an update. I was hoping to speak to Natalie.
I've never met Janet Grady face to face, but in my head, she's about 6'3" with a moustache. The first time we ever spoke, she told me the team at Leonidas Sports are all tough thinkers, hard players, and have an iron grip on the market. They sound terrifying. Oh, right. I twist the phone cord around my fingers. Well, unfortunately, Natalie's still, poorly. This is the story I've been spinning ever since Natalie didn't make it back from Goa. Luckily, you just have to say, she's been to India, and everyone launches into their own my horrendous travelling illness story without asking any more questions. But we're making great headway, I continue. Really marvellous. We're working through the long list, and there's a file of very strong candidates right here on my desk. We'll be looking at a top-class shortlist, I can assure you. All tough thinkers.
Can you give me any names?
Not right now. My voice jumps in panic. I'll fill you in nearer the time, but you'll be very impressed.
Okay, Lara.
Janet is one of those women who never waste time on small talk.
Well, as long as you're on top of it. Best to Natalie. Goodbye.
I replace the receiver and meet Kate's eyes, my heart thumping. Remind me, who do we have as possibles for Leonidas Sports?
The guy with a 3-year gap in his resume, says Kate, and the weirdo with the dandruff, and the kleptomaniac woman.
I wait for her to continue. She gives a tiny apologetic shrug. That's all.
Paul Richards pulled out yesterday, she says anxiously. He's been offered a position at some American company. Here's the list.
She hands me the sheet of paper, and I stare at the three names in total despair. They're all no-hopers. We can't send this list in. God, headhunting is hard. I had no idea. Before we started up the company, Natalie always made it seem so exciting. She talked about the thrill of the chase, strategic hiring and upskilling and the tap on the shoulder. We used to meet every few weeks for a drink, and she was full of such amazing stories about her work, I couldn't help feeling envious. Writing promotional website copy for a car manufacturer seemed really dull in comparison. Plus, there were rumours we were going to have big layoffs. So when Natalie suggested a start-up, I jumped at the chance. The truth is, I've always been a bit in awe of Natalie. She's so glossy and confident. Even when we were at school, she always had the latest slang and could blag us into pubs. And when we first started off the company, it all worked brilliantly. She brought in some big bits of business for us at once and was constantly out networking. I was writing our website and supposedly learning all the tricks from her. It was all going in the right direction, until she disappeared, and I realised I hadn't actually learned any tricks at all. Natalie's really into business mantras, and they're all on post-its around her desk. I keep sidling over and studying them, as if they're the runes to some ancient religion, trying to divine what I'm meant to do. For example, the best talent is already in the market is stuck up above her computer. That one I do know. It means you're not supposed to go through the resumes of all the bankers who were fired from an investment bank last week and try to make them sound like marketing directors. You're supposed to go after existing marketing directors. But how? What if they won't even speak to you? After doing this job for several weeks on my own, I have a few new mantras, which go as follows. The best talent doesn't answer the phone itself. The best talent doesn't ring back, even if you leave 3 messages with its secretary. The best talent doesn't want to move into sports retail. When you mention the 50% employee discount on tennis rackets, the best talent just laughs at you. I pull out our original, crumpled, coffee-stained long list for the millionth time and flick through it gloomily. Names glitter off the page like shiny sweeties. Employed, bona fide talent. The marketing director of Woodhouse Retail. The European marketing head at Dartmouth Plastics. They can't all be happy at their jobs, surely. There must be someone out there who would love to work for Leonidas Sports. But I've tried every single name and got nowhere. I glance up to see Kate standing on one foot, surveying me anxiously, the other leg wrapped around her calf. We have precisely 3 weeks to find a tough-thinking, hard-hitting marketing director for Leonidas Sports. I'm trying desperately to stay positive. Natalie landed this deal. Natalie was going to woo all the starry candidates. Natalie knows how to do this. I don't. Anyway, no point dwelling on that now. Okay, I slap my hand on the desk. I'm going to make some calls. I'll make you a fresh coffee. Kate springs into action. We'll stay here all night if we have to. I love Kate. She acts like she's in a film about some really thrusting multinational company, instead of 2 people in a 10-foot square office with mouldy carpet. Salary, 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 she says as she sits down. You snooze, you lose, I respond. Kate got into reading Natalie's mantras too. Now we can't stop quoting them at each other. The trouble is they don't actually tell you how to do the job. What I need is the mantra telling you how to get past the question, may I ask what it is in connection with? I swing my chair over to Natalie's desk to get out all the Leonidas Sports paperwork. The cardboard file has fallen off its hangers inside her drawer, so with a muttered curse, I gather all the papers together and pull them out. Then suddenly I stop, as I notice an old post-it, which has somehow attached itself to my hand. I've never seen this before. James Yates, Mobile, is written in faded purple felt tip. And then a number. A mobile number for James Yates. I don't believe it. He's marketing director at Felton's Breweries. He's on the long list. He'd be perfect. Whenever I've tried his office, I've been told he's abroad. But wherever he is, he'll have his mobile, won't he? Trembling with excitement, I push my chair back to my own desk and dial the number.
James Yates?
The line is a little crackly, but I can still hear him. Hi, I say, trying to sound as confident as possible. It's Lara Linton here. Can you talk? This is what Natalie always says on the phone. I've heard her.
Who is this?
He sounds suspicious.
Did you say you're from Linton's?
I give an inward sigh. No, I'm from L&N Executive Recruitment, and I was phoning to see if you'd be interested in a new position, heading up marketing in a dynamic, growing retail company. It's a very exciting opportunity, so if you'd like to discuss it, perhaps over a discreet lunch at a restaurant of your choice. I'm going to die if I don't breathe, so I stop and gasp for air.
L&N?
He sounds wary.
I don't know you.
We're a relatively new outfit. Myself and Natalie Masser.
Not interested.
He cuts me off. It's a marvellous opportunity, I say quickly. You'll have a chance to expand your horizons. There's a lot of exciting potential in Europe.
Sorry, goodbye.
And a 10% discount on sportswear. I call desperately down the dead phone. He's gone. He didn't even give me a chance. What did he say? Kate approaches, her hands clutched hopefully around a coffee cup. He hung up. I slump in my chair as Kate puts down the coffee. We're never going to get anyone good. Yes, we will, says Kate, just as the phone starts ringing. Maybe this is some brilliant executive who's longing for a new job. She hurries back to her desk and picks up the phone with her best assistant's manner. Allenden Executive Recruitment. Oh, Shireen, great to hear from you. I'll put you through to Lara. She beams at me and I grin back. At least we've had one triumph. I suppose, strictly speaking, it was Natalie's triumph, since she made the placement, but I've been doing all the follow-up work. Anyway, it's a company triumph. Hi, Shireen, I say cheerfully. All set for the new job? I just know it's going to be a great position for you. Lara, Shireen interrupts tensely. There's a problem. My stomach plunges. No, no, please, no problems. Problem? I force myself to sound relaxed. What kind of problem? It's my dog. Your dog? I'm intending to take Flash into work every day, but I just phoned Human Resources about setting up a basket for him, and they said it was impossible. They said it wasn't their policy to allow animals in the offices. Can you believe it? She clearly expects me to be as outraged as she is. I stare at the phone in bewilderment. How has a dog suddenly entered the picture? Lara, are you there? Yes, I come too. Shireen, listen to me. I'm sure you're really fond of Flash, but it's not usual to take dogs into the workplace. Yes, it is, she interrupts. There's another dog in the building. I've heard it every time I've been in. That's why I assumed it would be fine. I never would have taken this job otherwise. They're discriminating against me. I'm sure they're not discriminating, I say hurriedly. I'll call them straight away. I put down the phone, then quickly dial the HR department at Macrosant. Hi, Jean. It's Lara Linton here, from LNN Executive Recruitment. I just wanted to clarify a small point. Is Shireen Moore permitted to bring her dog to work? The whole building has a no-dog policy, says Jean pleasantly. I'm sorry, Lara, it's an insurance thing. Of course, absolutely, I understand. I pause. The thing is, Shireen believes she's heard another dog in the building. Several times. She's mistaken, Jean says after the tiniest of beats. There are no dogs here. None at all. Not even one little puppy. My suspicions have been aroused by that pause. Not even one little puppy. Jean has regained her smoothness. As I say, there's a no-dog policy in the building. And you couldn't make an exception for Shireen? I'm afraid not. She's polite but implacable. Well, thanks for your time. I put the phone down and tap my pencil silently on my notepad for a few seconds. Something's up. I bet there is a dog there. But what can I do about it? I can't exactly phone Jean back and say, I don't believe you. With a sigh, I redial Shireen's number. Lara, is that you? She picks up straight away, as though she's been sitting by the phone waiting for an answer, which she probably has. She's very bright, Shireen, and very intense. I can picture her now, drawing that endless crisscross of squares which she obsessively doodles everywhere. She probably needs a dog, just to stay sane. Yes, it's me. I called Jean, and she says no one else in the building has a dog. She says it's an insurance thing. There's silence as Shireen digests this. She's lying, she says at last. There is a dog in there. Shireen, I feel like banging my head against the desk. Couldn't you have mentioned the dog before? At one of the interviews, maybe? I assumed it would be okay, she says defensively. I heard the other dog barking. You can tell when there's a dog in a place. Well, I'm not working without Flash. I'm sorry, Lara. I'll have to pull out of the job. No, I cry out in dismay before I can stop myself. I mean, please don't do anything rash, Shireen. I'll sort this out, I promise. I'll call you soon. Breathing heavily, I put the phone down and bury my head in my hands. Crap! What are you going to do? Ventures Kate anxiously. She clearly overheard the whole thing. I don't know, I admit. What would Natalie do? Both of us instinctively glance toward Natalie's desk, gleaming and empty. I have a sudden vision of Natalie sitting there, her lacquered nails tapping on the desk, her voice raised in some high-octane call. Since she's been gone, the volume level in this office has dropped by about 80%. "She might tell Shireen she had to take the job and threaten to sue her if she didn't," says Kate at last. "She'd definitely tell Shireen to get over herself," I nod in agreement. "She'd call her unprofessional and flaky." I once heard Natalie tearing a strip off some guy who had second thoughts about taking up a position in Dubai. It wasn't pretty. The deep-down truth, which I don't want to admit to anyone, is that now I've got to know the way Natalie thinks and does business, I don't really relate to a lot of it. What appealed to me about this job was working with people, changing lives. When we used to meet up, and Natalie would tell me her stories of finding talent, I was always just as interested in the story behind the deal as the deal itself. I thought it must be so much more satisfying to help people's careers than to sell cars. But that aspect doesn't seem to feature highly on our agenda. I mean, okay, I know I'm a novice, and maybe I am a bit idealistic, like Dad always says. But your job is one of the most important things in your life, surely. It should be right for you. Salary isn't everything. There again, that'll be why Natalie's the successful headhunter with loads of commission under her belt, and I'm not. And right now we need commission. So what we're saying is, I should ring Shireen back and give her a hard time, I say reluctantly. There's silence. Kate looks as pained as I feel. Thing is, Lara, she says hesitantly, you're not Natalie. She's away. So you're the boss. So you should do things your way. Yes, I feel a surge of relief. That's true. I'm the boss. So what I say is, I'll think about it for a while first. Trying to look as though this is a decisive piece of action instead of a cop-out, I push the phone aside and start leafing through the post. A bill for office paper. An offer to send all my staff on a team-building trip to Aspen. And, at the bottom of the pile, business people, which is like the celebrity magazine of business. I open it and start flipping through the pages, trying to find someone who would make a perfect marketing director for Leonidas Sports. Business people is essential reading for a headhunter. It's basically endless photo spreads of thrusting, super-groomed types who have massive offices with plenty of space to hang up their coats. But God, it's depressing. As I turn from one high flyer to another, my spirits sink lower and lower. What's wrong with me? I speak only one language. I haven't been asked to chair any international committees. I don't have a working wardrobe which pairs Dolce & Gabbana trouser suits with quirky shirts from Paul Smith. Dolefully, I close the magazine and slump back, staring at the grimy ceiling. How do they all do it? My Uncle Bill, everyone in this magazine. They decide to run a business, and it's instantly a success. And it looks so easy. Yes? Yes. Suddenly I become aware of Kate making semaphore signals across the room. I look up to see her face all pink with excitement as she talks on the phone. I'm sure Lara would be able to make space for you in her schedule, if you could just hold on a moment. She presses hold and squeaks, It's Clive Hoxton, the one who said he wasn't interested in Leonidas Sports. She adds at my blank look, The rugby guy? Well, he might be after all. He wants to have lunch and talk about it. Oh, my God! Him! My spirits shoot back up. Clive Hoxton is marketing director at Arbury Stores and used to play rugby for Doncaster. He couldn't be more perfect for the Leonidas Sports job, but when I first approached him, he said he didn't want to move. I can't believe he's got in touch. Play it cool, I whisper urgently. Pretend I'm really busy interviewing other candidates. Kate nods vigorously. Let me just see, she says into the phone. Lara's schedule is very packed today, but I'll see what I can do. Ah, now what a stroke of luck. She unexpectedly has a vacancy. Would you like to name a restaurant? She grins broadly at me, and I give her an air high five. Clive Hoxton is an A-list name. He's tough-thinking and hard-playing. He'll totally make up for the weirdo and the kleptomaniac. In fact, if we get him, I'll axe the kleptomaniac, I decide. And the weirdo isn't that bad, if we could just get rid of his dandruff. All fixed up. Kate puts the phone down. You're having lunch today at 1 o'clock. Excellent. Where? Well, that's the only thing. Kate hesitates. I asked him to name a restaurant, and he named... She breaks off. What? My heart starts to thump anxiously. Not Gordon Ramsay. Not that posh one in carriages. Kate winces. Worse. Lyle Place. My insides shrivel. You have to be kidding. Lyle Place opened about 2 years ago and was instantly christened the most expensive restaurant in Europe. It has a massive lobster tank and a fountain, and loads of celebrities go there. Obviously, I've never been there. I've just read about it in the Evening Standard. We should never, never, never have let him name the restaurant. I should have named it. I would have named Pasta Pot, which is around the corner and does a set lunch for £12.95, including a glass of wine. I don't even think how much lunch for two at Lyle Place is going to be. We won't be able to get in, I say in sudden relief. It'll be too busy. He said he can get a reservation. He knows some people. He'll put it in your name. Damn. Kate is nibbling at her thumbnail anxiously. How much is in the client entertainment, Kitty? About 50 pence, I say in despair. We're broke. I'll have to use my own credit card. Well, it'll be worth it, says Kate resolutely. It's an investment. You've got to look like a mover and a shaker. If people see you eating at Lyle Place, they'll think, wow, Lara Lington must be doing well if she can afford to take clients here. But I can't afford it, I wail. Could we phone him up and change it to a cup of coffee? Even as I'm saying it, I know how lame this would look. If he wants lunch, I have to give him lunch. If he wants to go to Lyle Place, we have to go to Lyle Place. Maybe it isn't as expensive as we think, says Kate hopefully. I mean, all the newspapers keep saying how bad the economy is, don't they? Maybe they've reduced the prices, or got a special offer. That's true. And maybe he won't order very much, I add in sudden inspiration. I mean, he's sporty. He won't be a big eater. Of course he won't, agrees Kate. He'll have, like, one tiny bit of sashimi and some water and dash off. And he definitely won't drink. Nobody drinks at lunch anymore. I'm feeling more positive about this already. Kate's right. No one drinks at business lunches these days, and we can keep it down to 2 courses, or even 1. A starter and a nice cup of coffee. What's wrong with that? And anyway, whatever we eat, it can't cost that much, can it? Oh, my God. I think I'm going to faint. Except I can't, because Clive Hoxton has just asked me to run through the specs of the job again. I'm sitting on a transparent chair at a white-clothed table. If I look to my right, I can see the famous giant lobster tank, which has crustaceans of all sorts clambering around on rocks and occasionally being scooped out in a metal net by a man on a ladder. Over to the left is a cage of exotic birds, whose cheeping is mingling with the background whooshing sound from the fountain in the middle of the room. Well, my voice is quite faint. As you know, Leonidas Sports has just taken over a Dutch chain. I'm talking on autopilot. My eyes keep darting down to the menu, printed on plexiglass. Every time I spot a price, I feel a fresh swoop of horror. Ceviche of salmon, origami style, £34. That's a starter. A starter! 6 oysters. £46. There's no special offer. There's no sign of any hard times. All around, diners are merrily eating and drinking as if this is all totally normal. Are they all bluffing? Are they all secretly quailing inside? If I stood on a chair and yelled, "It's too expensive! I'm not going to take this any more," would I start a mass walkout? Obviously the board wants a new marketing director who can oversee this expansion. I have no idea what I'm blabbering about. I'm psyching myself up to peek at the main courses. Fillet of duck with three-way orange mash. £59. My stomach lurches again. I keep doing mental math and reaching 300 and feeling a bit sick.
Some mineral water?
The waiter appears at the table and proffers a blue-tinted plexiglass square to each of us.
This is our water menu. If you like a sparkling water, the Chetwynd Glen is rather fun,
he adds.
It's filtered through volcanic rock and has a subtle alkalinity.
Ah, I force myself to nod intelligently, and the waiter meets my eyes without a flicker. Surely they all get back into the kitchen, collapse against the walls and start snorting with laughter.
She paid £15 for water.
I'd prefer Pellegrino.
Clive shrugs. He's a guy in his 40s with greying hair, froggy eyes and a moustache, and he hasn't smiled once since we sat down.
A bottle of each, then?
Says the waiter. No, not two bottles of overpriced water. So, what would you like to eat, Clive? I smile. If you're in a hurry, we could go straight to main courses.
I'm not in any hurry.
Clive gives me a suspicious look.
Are you?
Of course not. I backtrack quickly. No hurry at all. I wave a generous hand. Have whatever you'd like. Not the oysters. Please, 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 not the oysters.
The oysters, to begin with,
he says thoughtfully.
Then I'm torn between the lobster and the porcini risotto.
I discreetly whip my eyes down to the menu. The lobster is £90. The risotto only £45. Tough choice. I try to sound casual. You know, risotto is always my favourite. There's silence as Clive frowns at the menu again. I love Italian food, I throw in with a relaxed little laugh. And I bet the porcini are delicious. But it's up to you, Clive.
If you can't decide,
the waiter puts in helpfully,
I could bring you both the lobster and a reduced-size risotto.
He could what? He could what? Who asked him to interfere anyway? Great idea! My voice is two notes shriller than I intended. Two main courses. Why not? I feel the waiter's sardonic eye on me, and instantly know he can read my thoughts. He knows I'm skint.
And for madam?
Right, absolutely. I run a finger down the menu with a thoughtful frown. The truth is, I went for a big power breakfast this morning, so I'll just have a Caesar salad. No starter.
One Caesar salad, no starter.
The waiter nods impassively. And would you like to stick to water, Clive? I desperately try to keep any hint of hope out of my voice. Or wine? Even the idea of the wine list makes my spine feel all twingy with fear.
Let's see the list.
Clive's eyes light up.
And a glass of vintage champagne to start, perhaps,
suggests the waiter with a bland smile. He couldn't just suggest champagne. He had to suggest vintage champagne. This waiter is a total sadist.
I could be persuaded.
Clive gives a sort of lugubrious chuckle, and somehow I force myself to join in. At last the waiter departs, having poured us each a zillion-pound glass of vintage champagne. I feel a bit giddy. I'm going to be paying off this lunch for the rest of my life, but it'll be worth it. I have to believe that. So, I say brightly, raising my glass, to the job. I'm so glad you've changed your mind, Clive.
I haven't,
he says, swigging about half of his champagne down in one gulp. I stare at him, unnerved. Am I going mad? Did Kate take down the message wrong? But I thought...
It's a possibility.
He starts to break up a bread roll.
I'm not happy with my job at the moment, and I'm considering a move. But there are drawbacks to this Leonidas sports gig, too. Sell it to me.
For a moment I'm too choked with dismay to answer. I'm spending the price of a small car on this man, and he might not even be interested in the job. I take a sip of water, then look up, forcing my most professional smile. I can be Natalie. I can sell this to him. Clive, you're not happy in your current post. For a man with your gifts, this is a criminal situation. Look at you. You should be in a place which will appreciate you. I pause, my heart thumping hard. He's listening attentively. He hasn't even buttered his bread roll yet. So far, so good. In my opinion, the job at Leonidas Sports would be the perfect career move for you. You're a former sportsman. It's a sporting goods company. You love to play golf. Leonidas Sports has a whole golfware line. Clive raises his eyebrows.
You've done your research on me at any rate.
I'm interested in people, I say honestly. And knowing your profile, it seems to me that Leonidas Sports is exactly what you need at this stage. This is a fantastic, unique opportunity to... Is that man your lover? A familiar, clipped voice interrupts me and I jump. That sounded just like... No, don't be ridiculous. I take a deep breath and resume. As I was saying, this is a fantastic opportunity to take your career to the next level. I'm sure that we could achieve a very generous package. I said, is that man your lover? The voice is more insistent, and before I can stop myself, I swivel my head. No, this can't be happening. She's back. It's Sadie, perched on a nearby cheese trolley. She's not in the green dress anymore. She's wearing a pale pink one with a dropped waistband and a matching coat over the top. There's a black band around her head, and from one of her wrists dangles a little grey silk bag on a beaded chain. The other hand is resting on a glass cheese dome, apart from her fingertips, which have sunk into it. She suddenly notices and pulls them out sharply, carefully positioning them on top of the glass. He's not terribly handsome, is he? I want some champagne, she adds imperiously, her eyes lighting on my drink. Ignore her. It's a hallucination. It's all in your head.
Lara, are you okay?
Sorry, Clive. I hastily turn back. Just got a bit distracted there. By the cheese trolley. It all looks so delicious. Oh, God. Clive doesn't seem amused. I need to get things back on track, quick. The real question to ask yourself, Clive, is this. I lean forward intently. Will an opportunity like this come along again? It's a unique chance to work with a great brand, to use all your proven talents and admired leadership skills. I want some champagne! To my horror, Sadie has materialized right in front of me. She reaches for my glass and tries to pick it up, but her hand goes through it. Drat! I can't pick it up. She reaches again, and again, then glares at me crossly. This is so irritating. Stop it, I hiss furiously.
I'm sorry.
Clive knits his heavy brows. Not you, Clive. Just got something caught in my throat. I grab my glass and take a gulp of water. Have you found my necklace yet? Sadie demands accusingly. No, I mutter from behind my glass. Go away. Then why are you sitting here? Why aren't you looking for it? Clive, I desperately try to focus back on him. I'm so sorry about that. What was I saying?
Admired leadership skills,
says Clive, without cracking a smile. That's right. Admired leadership skills. So the point is, haven't you looked anywhere? She thrusts her head close to mine. Don't you care about finding it? So, what I'm trying to say is, it's taking every ounce of willpower to ignore Sadie and not bat her away. In my opinion, this job is a great strategic move. It's a perfect springboard for your future. And furthermore, you've got to find my necklace. It's important. It's very, very... Furthermore, I know the generous benefits package will... Stop ignoring me! Sadie's face is practically touching mine. Stop talking! Stop! Shut up and leave me alone. Shit. Did that just come out of my mouth? From the shell-shocked way Clive's froggy eyes have widened, I'm guessing the answer is yes. At two neighbouring tables, conversations have come to a halt, and I can see our supercilious waiter pausing to watch. The buzz of clashing cutlery and conversation seems to have died away all around. Even the lobsters seem to be lined up at the edge of the tank watching.
Clive!
I give a strangled laugh.
I didn't mean... Obviously, I wasn't talking to you.
Lara?
Clive fixes me with a hostile gaze.
Please do me the courtesy of telling me the truth.
I can feel my cheeks staining red. I was just... I clear my throat desperately. What can I say? I was talking to myself. No. I was talking to a vision. No.
I'm not a fool.
He cuts me off contemptuously.
This isn't the first time this has happened to me.
It isn't. I peer at him, bemused.
I've had to put up with it in board meetings, in directors' lunches. It's the same everywhere. Blackberries are bad enough, but these hands-free sets are a bloody menace. You know how many car accidents people like you cause.
Hands-free? Does he mean... He thinks I was on the phone. I wasn't, I begin automatically, then stop myself. Being on the phone is the most sane option available to me. I should go with it.
But this really is the pits.
He glowers at me, breathing heavily.
Taking a call during a one-to-one lunch, hoping I might not notice. It's fucking disrespectful.
I'm sorry, I say humbly. I'll switch it off now. With a fumbling hand, I reach up to my ear and pretend to switch off an earpiece.
Where is it anyway?
He frowns at me.
I can't see it.
It's tiny, I say hastily. Very discreet.
Is it the new Nokia?
He's peering more closely at my ear. Shit. It's actually, embedded in my earring. I hope I sound convincing. New technology. Clive, I'm really sorry I was distracted. I misjudged the situation, but I am very sincere about wanting to place you with Leonidas Sports. So if I could maybe just recap on what I was trying to say.
You have to be joking.
But...
You think I'm going to do business with you now?
He gives a short, unamused laugh.
You're as unprofessional as your partner, and that's saying something.
To my horror, he pushes back his chair and gets to his feet.
I was going to give you a chance, but forget it.
No! Wait, please! I say in panic, but he's already striding away between the tables of gawping diners. I feel hot and cold as I stare at his empty chair. With a still shaky hand, I reach for my champagne and take three deep gulps. So that's that. I fucked up. My best hope is gone. And anyway, what did he mean? I'm as unprofessional as my partner. Has he heard about Natalie disappearing off to Goa? Does everyone know?
Will the gentleman be returning?
My trance is interrupted by the waiter approaching the table. He's holding a wooden platter, bearing a dish with a silver dome on it. I don't think so. I stare at the table, my face burning with humiliation.
Shall I return his food to the kitchen?
Do I still have to pay for it?
Unfortunately, madam, yes.
He gives me a patronizing smile.
Since it has been ordered, and everything is cooked from fresh...
Then I'll have it.
All of it?
He seems taken aback. Yes. I lift my chin mutinously. Why not? I'm paying for it. I might as well eat it.
Very good.
The waiter inclines his head, deposits the platter in front of me, and removes the silver dome.
Half a dozen fresh oysters on crushed ice.
I've never eaten oysters in my life. I've always thought they looked gross. Close up, they look even grosser, but I'm not admitting that. Thanks, I say curtly. The waiter retreats, and I stare fixedly at the six oysters in front of me. I'm determined to see this stupid lunch out. But there's a tight, pressing feeling behind my cheekbones, and my bottom lip would be trembling if I allowed it.
Oysters! I adore oysters!
To my disbelief, Sadie appears in front of my eyes again. She sinks into Clive's vacated chair with a languid, sideways movement, looks around, and says, "This place is rather fun. Is there a cabaret?" "I can't hear you," I mutter savagely. "I can't see you. You don't exist. I'm going to the doctor and getting some drugs and getting rid of you."
"Where's your lover gone?"
"He wasn't my lover," I snap in low tones. "I was trying to do business with him, and it's all spoiled because of you. You've ruined everything. Everything."
"Oh."
She arches her eyebrows unrepentantly. "I don't see how I could do that if I don't exist." "Well, you did. And now I'm stuck with these stupid oysters that I don't want and can't afford, and I don't even know how to eat them."
"It's easy to eat an oyster."
"No, it isn't." I suddenly notice a blonde woman in a print dress at the next table, nudging the perfectly groomed woman next to her and pointing at me. I'm talking to thin air. I look like a lunatic. Hastily, I reach for a bread roll and start to butter it, avoiding Sadie's eye.
"Excuse me."
The woman leans over and smiles at me. "I couldn't help overhearing your conversation. I don't mean to interrupt, but did you just say your phone's embedded in your earring?" I stare back at her, my mind scrabbling for an answer other than yes. "Yes," I say at last. The woman claps a hand to her mouth. "That's amazing. How does it work?"
"It has a special chip. Very new. Japanese.
I have to get one." She's gazing at my Claire's Accessories £5.99 earring, awestruck. "Where do they sell them?"
"Actually, this is a prototype," I say hurriedly. "They'll be available in a year or so."
"Well, how did you get one, then?" She gives me an aggressive look.
I know Japanese people. Sorry.
"Could I see?" She holds out her hand. "Could you take it out of your ear for a moment? Would you mind?"
"A call's just coming in," I say hastily. "It's vibrating."
"I can't see anything." She's peering incredulously at my ear.
"It's very subtle," I say desperately. "They're micro-vibrations. Hello? Matt?"
"Yes, I can talk." I mime apologies to the woman, and reluctantly she returns to her meal. I can see her pointing me out to all her friends.
"What are you talking about?"
Sadie's eyeing me disdainfully.
"How can a telephone be in an earring? It sounds like a riddle."
"I don't know. Don't you start quizzing me, too." I prod an oyster with little enthusiasm.
"Do you really not know how to eat an oyster?"
"Never eaten one before in my life." Sadie shakes her head disapprovingly.
"Pick up your fork. The shellfish fork. Go on."
Casting her a suspicious look, I do as she says. "Ease it around. Make sure it's detached from the shell. Now give it a squeeze of lemon and pick it up. Like this." She mimes picking up an oyster, and I copy. Head back and swallow the whole thing. Bottoms up. It's like swallowing a piece of jellified sea. Somehow I manage to slurp down the whole thing, grab my glass and take a swig of champagne. "You see?" Sadie is watching me greedily. "Isn't that too delicious?"
"It's okay,"
I say reluctantly. I put my glass down and survey her silently for a moment. She's reclining on the chair as though she owns the place, one arm flung to the side, her beaded bag dangling down. She's all in my head, I tell myself. My subconscious has invented her. Except my subconscious doesn't know how to eat an oyster. Does it?
"What is it?"
She juts out her chin. "Why are you looking at me like that?" My brain is edging very slowly to a conclusion. To the only possible conclusion. You're a ghost, aren't you? I say at last. You're not a hallucination. You're a proper, real, live ghost. Sadie gives a remote shrug, as though she's really not interested in this conversation. Aren't you? Again, Sadie doesn't reply. Her head is tilted, and she's examining her fingernails. Maybe she doesn't want to be a ghost. Well, too bad. She is. You are a ghost. I know you are. So, what, am I psychic? My head is prickling all over as this revelation hits me. I feel a bit shivery. I can talk to the dead. Me, Lara Lington. I always knew there was something different about me. Think of the implications. Think what this means. Maybe I'll start talking to more ghosts. Lots of ghosts. Oh, my God. I could have my own TV show. I could go around the world. I could be famous. I have a sudden vision of myself on a stage, channeling spirits while an audience watches avidly. With a surge of excitement, I lean across the table. Do you know any other dead people you could introduce me to? No. Sadie folds her arms crossly. I don't. Have you met Marilyn Monroe? Or Elvis? Or Princess Diana? What's she like? Or Mozart? I feel almost dizzy as possibilities pile into my head. This is mind-blowing. You have to describe it. You have to tell me what it's like. There. Where? Sadie tosses her chin. There. You know. I haven't been anywhere. She glares at me. I haven't met anybody. I wake up and it's as though I'm in a dream. A very bad dream. Because all I want is my necklace. But the only person who can understand me refuses to help me. She looks so accusing, I feel a surge of indignation. Well, maybe if you didn't come along and ruin everything, that person might want to help you. Did you think of that? I didn't ruin everything. Yes, you did. I taught you how to eat an oyster, didn't I? I didn't want to know how to eat a bloody oyster. I wanted my candidate not to walk out. For a moment, Sadie looks cornered. Then her chin juts out again. I didn't know he was your candidate. I thought he was your lover. Well, my business is probably sunk now, and I can't afford any of this stupid food. It's all a disaster, and it's all your fault.